I just really fell in love with it. It's just, it's got a very different feel to his other films.
The acting was not very good, and everyone is doing an accent. Like Scarlett Johansson is doing like 7 accents that she sort of drifts in and out of. And the female characters are just sort of chattels for...
Oh yeah, they're dreadful.
...straight white men and their problems.
The idea that, you know, Angier gets in the machine each night and doesn't know if he's going to be the guy drowning or the guy at the back of the room. Like, that's a great, great concept. I think that's really... But it's really nasty.
I just don't think this film is as clever as it acts like it is.
Well, that's true of many Christopher Nolan films, let's be honest.
Oh, yes.
Hello, welcome to Flicks Watcher. Joining us today, we have Helen H.
Hello.
Helen Z.
Hi.
And not Helen, Kobe.
Hello.
Honorary Helen.
And we're here to review The Prestige. Thank you, as always, to the mighty people for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher. Hello, film fans. Welcome to this episode of Flicks Watcher Podcast. Joining us remotely today, we have Helen O'Hara and Helen Zaltzman. If you could please say hello to our listeners and tell them a little bit more about who you are and what you do, please.
Hello, I'm Helen O'Hara. I'm a film journalist for, among others, Empire Magazine and the Empire Podcast. And I have just written a new book called Women vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film, which is out this week.
I'm Helen Zaltzman. I'm a podcaster. I make shows such as The Allusionist, an entertainment show about language, Answer Me This, where we answer questions on myriad topics, and Veronica Mars Investigations, where we recap the television show Veronica Mars.
Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Can you tell us about the book, Women vs. Hollywood, which will be out now as you're listening to this podcast? Do your plug, because we wanted you to come on to talk about your book. Go on.
Okay, so this is...
Do the pamphlet.
Thank you. This is a foolish attempt to try and sum up 100 years of Hollywood history and look into the future from the point of view of women in film. So basically trying to figure out why there were so many women in the silent era who were kind of pushed out by the studios, and how women are finally beginning to kind of get back into some of the major roles in the profession. So I've kind of taken it era by era, and then in the more modern times I've kind of tried to go issue by issue and look at how all of these multiple forces interact, like directors, franchise movies, awards, critics, Me Too, like how do all these things interact, and how do we change the picture to make it a bit more equal in future?
And yeah, I've read the book and I thought it was fantastic and insightful and super entertaining. Listeners, as a cinephile, I was quite shocked by a lot of the stuff that happens and has happened, and hopefully it does seem to be course correcting. And I think one thing is, as a loose book, don't presume it's course corrected by now, because three female directors got nominated for the Golden Globes. That doesn't rectify everything. You might have some good years in terms of representation, but then it needs to be a trajectory that continues. And I think that's still in the book, is prevalent, that's still not the case, but it shows that there's a light, I think.
Yeah, I think the fact that people are talking about it now really matters. And I know, as you know, we're all people who talk about it, so we would like to think that. But I genuinely do think that's moving the needle, because, you know, things that were not an issue 5 or 10 years ago, trans representation, the idea that trans people should play trans people was not a concern of anybody in Hollywood 5 or 10 years ago. And that has completely come up to be a major, major issue. I think disabled people having the opportunity to play themselves is going to be the next major, major issue, because I think it's just not acceptable anymore for, you know, able-bodied actors to keep playing disabled roles. I think there's been something like 32 Oscar winners in disabled roles, and 2 of them had a disability. I mean, these are not good statistics. So, you know, these are the kind of things that we need to have a conversation about and maybe change, because, you know, we can... There can absolutely be a conversation about, well, actors should be able to play anything. And that's sure, okay, great. But that shouldn't just be straight white actors. able-bodied actors who can play anything. It should be everybody in that case who gets a chance. So yeah, there's a long way to go, but I think we're hopefully headed in the right direction.
And I think that's really true for the whole kind of underrepresented voices spectrum, like say disabled, race, gender, and sexuality. And I think if everything was equal and everyone could play any role, then absolutely acting is acting. But I think there needs to be a redressing of the balance until it's a bit fair. And someone asked me about, it was because Russell T. Davis, his amazing TV show, It's a Sin. And he said it should be, he picked gay actors to play the gay roles, where previously that wouldn't really been a thing. And initially I was like, why do you need to do that? Because they're all kind of cis appearing men and acting is acting. But then speaking to a few friends of mine, they were saying, it's analogous to female, race and disabled, that the stories just there's not enough stories specifically for them. Yeah. And people see a lot in themselves projected on the screen. If there's not enough representation, then that should also be, we need to carry that through the whole grain of the production. And I think until that balance is redressed, I don't know. This is a bit of a weird soapboxing. But until that balance is redressed across the board, I think we need to push these things forward. And I think Women versus Hollywood is doing exactly that.
Oh, thank you.
And I love the way you do talk about the other underrepresented voices in there as well. So,
well, yeah, because I mean, like, if it's if it's sort of quote unquote white feminism, as they call it on the internet, and it's just for middle class white women, then it's kind of worthless. So I tried from the beginning to kind of build that in. And the difficult thing about doing a book like this, and sort of, I'm relying on history books, obviously, for the bits where I can't go out and interview people. And the problem is that, black people or Asian people or disabled people aren't in the history books because they never got the chance in the first place. So it's trying to keep in mind the stories that aren't there and the sort of gaps in the history, and hopefully point out why that was, So yeah, it's laughably overambitious, but I've tried to at least get a starter pack, and then there's a big bibliography in the back, so I can hopefully guide people to much more expert and in-depth accounts of Hollywood history.
Guys, go there, read it, and enjoy. Saltzman.
Hello.
You've got lots of podcasts. You're the original Helen of podcasting.
She is, yeah.
Well, it's not a contest. It's all the podcasting.
You
Helens
paved the way for all the Helens.
Equals. I like to think that, as a pioneer for Helen representation, all the people with a name that peaked in popularity in about 1915. I have podcasts. The Illusionist, I suppose The Illusionist covers some of the overlapping topics in that there's a lot of like oppression through language and a lot of erasure and a lot of history that is overwritten. So they're like, no, there have only ever been cis straight people. And you're like, well, there's evidence of that before, but you have you've only recorded things to demonstrate that point of view, for instance. You get into language podcasting because you think, well, that'll be interesting and fun. And then it's just ever increasing fury about things done to perpetuate power imbalances in this world. I also make a podcast recapping Veronica Mars, the television show, and we're just about to reach the 2014 fan-funded movie. And so if you want to watch it along with me and my co-host Jenny Owen Youngs, we're going to be watching it on Saturday, 27th of February.
Ooh, which will be out a couple of weeks after this is out, so set a date. Are you doing a live watch-along?
We're going to do a live watch-along, yeah.
Excellent. And how do people find that?
Just go to our Twitter, which is at VMIPod.
Excellent. Right, we're here talking about other films. Another film. And today that film is The Prestige, which is Helen O's choice.
Hello.
Can you tell us, first of all, Helen, why you chose The Prestige and what's it about, if you can explain it in less than a minute?
I chose it because it had been a while since I watched it, but I have spent much of the intervening time telling everybody that it was my favourite Christopher Nolan film, and I wanted to actually go back and make sure that was still the case.
Did you rewatch all of them to check?
No, nobody has that much time. It's the story of two dueling magicians, Alfred Borden, played by Christian Bale, and Hugh Jackman, who plays Robert Angier, start off as apprentices to the same man and through a series of unfortunate events become bitter, bitter rivals. And the rivalry consumes them and their families and their entire lives, and it doesn't go well for anybody.
I want to know what Helen Zed said. When it said the other film's going to be The Prestige, when I said the film's going to be The Prestige, you were like, I don't get on well with Christopher Nolan. So what? Good to hear what your thoughts out of the gate for this one, Zaltzman, versus...
I was keen to know all of your thoughts because I wanted to know what it is that is not doing it for me that I should be feeling. Because I'd never seen it before. And coming into it, I thought that the acting was not very good and everyone is doing an accent. Like Scarlett Johansson is doing like 7 accents that she sort of drifts in and out of. And the female characters are just sort of chattels for...
Oh yeah, they're dreadful.
..straight white men and their problems. And I feel like I don't have that much room in my heart for films that are about straight white men and their problems at the moment. Perhaps never again.
See, look, some of my best friends are straight white men, you know.
Oh, I don't want to. Yeah, they can stay. Yeah, I just don't want to watch films about their problems either.
Mm. I 100% agree on the female characters. Like, Christopher Nolan has a very bad habit of killing off women in his films, and in particular, wives in his films.
Oh, it's like motivation, and, dead wife. Great, carry on. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, move. Yeah. And really, we need more motivations. I'm very, very over the dead wife as a motivation for anything in any film ever. Having said that, what I like about this is I think it plays to his strengths because he is a very chilly, logical director. Mm. And sometimes when he tries to direct emotion, fails utterly. Witness that scene in Interstellar. And I think he's at his best when he's doing a tricksy puzzle box film about really nasty people like this. And that's why I think this is his best film, because it kind of suits him in a way that some of his more recent efforts do not, in my opinion.
There's an awful lot of time jumps in this film, 146. And I was wondering, as I was lying in bed after having watched it, I thought, were those actually narratively necessary? I know that it sort of like makes things seem more clever because you're like, oh, well, that was in the past and that was in the future. But actually, was the narrative well served by doing that?
Well, he likes playing with time, doesn't he, Nolan? That's his big thing, as well as maligning women.
Or killing them. Then you don't have to malign them because they're dead.
Exactly, yeah. Phrasing.
Is it pretty much Catwoman? Is that the only decent female character who's written? Is she decent?
Great. She's pretty good, yeah. She's not, I mean, she's no Michelle Pfeiffer, but she's pretty good. he would probably claim Anne Hathaway in Interstellar as well. I would disagree with him. You know, there's various female characters that people make a case for. I have yet to be convinced by any of those cases in any of his films. So,
Helen Sadler.
So, I'm a huge fan of this film. At the same time, I completely take on board everything about the female characters in it. But it's got lots of things that I really enjoy, and it's the most complete Nolan film. It's the one where pretty much everyone can get to the end of it and go, yep, I know what that was about. I'm fine with that. I understand the story and what was going on and the people involved. And and it's got David Bowie in it as well, in one of my favourite roles of him. And even though the female characters aren't great, Rebecca Hall does play her part of Sarah really beautifully, and that just about kind of makes it okay for me. So while at the same time I completely understand everything you said, when I saw this back in 2006, I just really fell in love with it. It's got a very different feel to his other films in that it feels quite warm in the moment, and there's just something quite literally magical about magic and seeing how it's broken down and how it's presented. And you know, the whole thing about it being this kind of wonderful, magical thing, but actually it's loads of birds getting smashed, has that really kind of weird juxtaposition that just appeals to me.
But then the big finish is not magic at all. It's basically like a big 3D printer.
Yeah, this is one of the things that people hate about this film, is that, you know, it promises a trick throughout, and the trick at the end is that it's real magic. And people hate that about it. And I think it's one of the cleverest things in the film. And the idea that, you know, Angio gets in the machine each night and doesn't know if he's going to be the guy drowning instantly or the guy at the back of the room. Like, that's a great, great concept. I think that's really, but it's really nasty. This is what I mean about the film being a nasty, nasty thing. Even apart from all the body horror of, you know, losing fingers and shooting each other and drowning and all that kind of stuff. That particular choice that he makes 100 times in a row for 100 shows is nasty.
But then they only address that in like a throwaway line, though. It would have been really interesting to contemplate that, or what it was like for like these twins to, you know, have to lose it. Well, I don't think they had to lose a finger. I thought they probably could have found a way around it. But like, why are they, you know, both temporarily living with the wife? One of them never has to meet Rebecca Hall. I don't know. I was curious about the twin logistics, what it does to one twin knowing that they're being executed, knowing that they're like breaking the heart of a woman that they're not really with. A lot of questions. And then also, just like, isn't Michael Caine in on the big ruse with all the Hugh Jackman bodies? How come he's surprised at the end? Like, if there's 100 Hugh Jackmans in tanks in the basement, how is that not attracting his attention?
Because he didn't let him backstage. There is a line about that, and he has the blind stage hands, so they do all the handling of the bodies.
But
why he's keeping
them
in the tanks makes no sense.
No, exactly. It seems highly
tanks were cheaper in those days.
I mean, yeah. That didn't make a huge amount of sense. I think with Freddie and Albert, which I think are their two actual names, if I remember correctly from the
Alfred
book, which is very good.
Yeah.
No, he's Alfred, but that's the two of them together. I think the twins' names are Alfred and Albert.
No, but I like that they put
they
twins.
Combined. Yeah.
I didn't even.
Yeah, it's Freddie and Albert, hence Alfred. But it's really gnarly again. I think that the whole idea that you get to live with your own face for one day out of two is tricksy. But I do like that, especially watching it again this time, I could generally tell which brother it was in any given scene. And I'm pretty sure it's Freddie, who's the one who fancies Scarlett Johansson, who dies at the end. And Albert, who was married to Rebecca Hall, survives to take care of his daughter.
It's in the voice and his facial expression. So even in that performance, he's doing so much that you can kind of tell, but then not enough so that it's really obvious. And I mean, I don't know if I'm just a very forgiving person, but when I watched it for the very, very first time, I didn't see it coming. I was like, oh, okay. And yet in subsequent watches, obviously know it now, and I get quite a lot of enjoyment from trying to do that, work out how and when and notice all the clues and everything. So I know people who've seen it in the first like 10 minutes ago, oh, he's a twin. It's like, how did you see that? I don't get that. But there are like some really like non-subtle ones, which when you know, when you've seen it a couple of times, when, you know, at the start, the little kid that Rebecca Hall is with and he says, well, where's his brother? And you're like, oh, there we go. Giving us
foreshadowing.
I think I clocked that halfway through when they're talking in a bar and one of them's like, well, double has power over you. And I was like, oh, everyone's got a fucking double.
Well, at the start when he's narrating over, he's talking about, we were two young men, just wanted to get ahead of magic. And he's talking about him and his brother rather than him and the great Danton. And that's where it kind of starts. But this is the second time I've seen it and I forgot that bit. It was Fallon. I remember mainly David Bowie for some reason. I don't know why that was the kind of overarching thing. And also the fact there's hundreds of Hugh Jacksmans somewhere across the English countryside. but I've forgotten that Fallon was himself and his brother at the same time. And again, I thought, shit, that's actually really clever. But then the logistics of it started to kind of play into my mind. So I think I maybe need to do Helen Sadler forensic rewatch. And pit who is who at which time.
The thing that really should have tipped us off to Fallon's identity is the fact that every role in this film is played by a really good character actor except him. And that's how we should have spotted it. Because there's like, there's Roger Rees and obviously Michael Caine, all these great people just like popping up, Andy Serkis, popping up for like a scene and a half at most. And then there's, you know, unnamed dude. And,
with the
and
weird
really,
beard.
With the beard. And we should have, and the fat cheeks, and we should have just known. We should have known.
I have a question about all of the Hugh Jackmans. So Lord What's-It has been pretending to be an American magician for years just for fun. And his wife, when she's still alive, is like, yes, dear, I'm going along with this. Or she's only known him in deep cover. And then also when he's hiring the actor to pop up at the other side of the stage, and it's him playing that actor. I was a bit surprised that they cast him as that, because the likelihood of finding, you know, a lookalike of anyone, like even identical twins don't tend to be as identical as Hugh Jackman and Hugh Jackman, let alone a non-related stranger. And also the audience would probably buy someone who's just like roughly same build, had the same hat and stick on moustache. So why do they cast Hugh Jackman in that? Is that just to be like extra, like, oh, who's really a double and who's an actor that they've hired?
Yeah, I think that was just to be extra. He does have a slightly prosthetic nose, but and a few other little bits and bits, I think some teeth as well. But yeah, basically they just thought, let's hire Hugh Jackman. And maybe that was a double bluff as well to take attention away from Bert and Freddie.
I just don't think this film is as clever as it acts like it is.
Well, that's true of many Christopher Nolan films, let's be honest. Yes.
So I guess this begs the question of, where does it rank in our Christopher Nolan list of films?
I mean, for me, it is literally top. It's this, and then probably Batman Begins, and then probably The Dark Knight at the top of my Christopher Nolan rankings. Controversial, I know, but there we are.
I think I'm probably the same. The Prestige, 100% up the top, and then depending on what mood I'm in, probably The Dark Knight, I think, and then...
We've had Inception, which you scored very highly.
Oh, yeah, shit, yeah, sorry, Inception. So, yeah, this, Inception, and then The Dark Knight. There we go, top three. And then, yeah, Tenet isn't really anywhere there, but I've only seen it once. And then Interstellar, I saw at the cinema once, and that's kind of it. And then Memento, I probably would have said that years and years ago, but I'd need to rewatch it to bump it up. But this by a long way.
Yeah, I think I haven't rewatched them since they came out, but I remember enjoying Memento. Well, enjoying, like, I appreciated Memento and Insomnia a lot when they came out. I don't know whether I would still like them in that way. And then I think I'd enjoy like an hour long supercut of the best bits of the Batman films, which is basically Heath Ledger and Anne Hathaway. So I'll put The Prestige below how I felt about Memento and Insomnia when they came out. Above the reality of the Batman trilogy, but below my supercut that doesn't exist, and then Inception below the Batmans, and then I haven't seen the other ones.
Tenet might just, yeah.
I mean, I'm fine without Tenet. Actually, I don't need it in my life, Kobe.
It's not bad. It's better than Interstellar, I think.
There's
a lot
need
of Interstellar stands, aren't there?
I guess
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not.
I've just reached a stage in my life where I'm so conscious of my own mortality and the lack of time to see all the films that I will enjoy in this life that I feel fine about having seen six Christopher Nolan films to be like, you know what? I don't think his shtick's for me. Also, he did a really, really boring Desert Island Discs, which is pretty much indefensible.
Oh, did he?
Oh, yeah. Oh. It was shocking.
Wasn't Ed Miliband did a really bad one? Was it Dave Miliband? That kind of sticks in my mind, but...
The most boring ones I think I've heard were Christopher Nolan, Ed Sheeran, and Gary Barlow. But Christopher Nolan is the one that I was most surprised that it was that boring. But I haven't listened to a lot of Football Manager
ones. I'm intrigued to hear it.
Although he does put a Tom York song at the end of the credits for this, which is a nice, if completely irrelevant, kind of piece of music to enjoy.
Radiohead or Tom York for his Desert Island Discs?
I don't remember. I think the music is not the main feature of Desert Island Discs, which is weird because it is the format. But what you remember is like what someone is willing to display of their character.
Oh, it is. 100%. But sometimes there's a song choice that just kind of sparks your imagination. You think, oh, you picked that.
Yeah. Like Nick Clegg picked a Waka Waka Song for Africa by Shakira.
Wow.
I'll never forget that.
That's a choice.
It is. Wow. I think it's because his little kid loved it.
Oh, I think, oh, yeah, okay, if there's cute. Reason, like, that's okay.
Right.
But I digress. If the format is you've got 8 discs to take to that you'd wish to be there and there's Alan with them, that's one of them. For any other reason than that, then he's an idiot. But that's fine, I think.
I don't remember Nolan picking Waka Waka.
He would never.
I think they'll be, I imagine them all being very kind of dry and have some kind of time play with them or be just really long. No, but female,
like a lot
artists.
Of Johnny Greenwood's sound, like scores.
Yeah.
Oh, I like Johnny.
I like Johnny.
Yeah, very nice. Oh. Just like Desert Island wise, though.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Anything else, guys, before we head to the scores?
Well, we're waiting for your Nolan list. You'd never.
Yeah, I'd only seen this once before, and as O'Hara said at the top of the show, I always said this is my favourite Nolan, even though only having seen it once. And I'd still say that's the case. Then alongside would be one of the Batman first two, Dark Knights. I'd have to rewatch because I've only seen it once. I've seen Batman Begins quite a few times though. And then a bit further down would be the others, Inception and the others, because sometimes I think there's just a bit of nonsense in there, which kind of, even though this has got real magic in there and the Tesla thing does cause duplications to happen, and one of the duplicates or the teleporting men, like Helen O'Hara said, I do like the fact that he didn't know if it was going to be him or the duplicate that drowns. Mm. I think that's a nice kind of, that's kind of the nicest touch here. There are leaps of fancy you have to take with this, I think, sometimes. But I think they're lesser than Interstellar and Tenet and other ones. I don't know if that's my point. So first of all, it's this, and then Batman's, and then and then Inception's. Let's head to the scores.
Hello, I'm Sam Pay.
And I'm Martin Zott-Sorstwick.
And together we host a show called Song by Song, where we deal with the music of Tom Waits. We've been going since 2015. Every week we talk about a new track. We've made our way through 15 seasons so far of his music.
And now we're going back to the early years. And if you haven't listened to Tom Waits before, it's not the growly stuff. It's not the stuff where he's hitting an automobile with a bone for percussion. It's a nice, easy way into his music.
If that sounds like something you would be interested in, you should check out our website, songbysongpodcast.com, or put Song by Song into your podcatcher of choice.
Welcome to the Flix Watcher scores. We've only been doing this for how long now? All of the scores are always out of 5. You may have decimal places if you wish, and we will start with you, Pellant O'Hara.
All right, what's our first category?
Recommendability.
This is high. I would say this is a 4. I feel like most people would want to see this or would be happy to have been recommended this, at least.
Saltzman.
It's tricky because if I was in the habit of recommending Christopher Nolan films, then I would recommend it, but I'm not. So I think I'm just going to give it 2.5 as a neutral score because I wouldn't.
Like the Swiss. Sadler.
So I recommend this to everyone, even though there are people like yourself, Helen said, who don't have any interest in Nolan. And I think that's fine. But I do think it's probably his most accessible film, and without having to like get your brain around time bending, you can watch it and at least go along with it. So I'm going to give it 4.8.
I'm going to go for 4.5 here. It's good, enjoyable, fair, and it's, I guess, like I said, I've only seen it twice in the space of like 10 years. It kept me going through this rewatch, and I think I need to rewatch it more. But if you haven't seen it, then 100% you should see this. 4.5. Repeat viewing score. Helen O'Hara.
I was really into it this time, and because it had been a while. But again, I'm probably going to go. I'm going to go 4. No, I'm just going to go 4. I'm trained at Empire. We stick to full numbers. It really hurts me to even do a 0.5, so I'm just going to stick with a 4. Yeah, I think I'm not saying I'd watch it every week, but I would happily watch this again.
Zaltzman.
I sort of wished that I had seen this when it came out, where I had a different mindset towards the Christopher Nolan shtick. I mean, I really did go into it with an open mind, wanting to enjoy it. And I think if I was rewatching it, then I'd be seeing things that I had previously liked in a different way. But seeing it for the first time now, when I'm not really transported by what he's doing. Yeah, I'm going to give it another neutral 2.5. And I feel generous by doing so. It's not what my heart wants to say.
I always think that Zaltzman should be a Ghostbusters name. Have you ever considered that?
Yeah, they would misspell it constantly, though. That's the irritation.
Well, you have to have it out there in your jumpsuit. It would be there, front and centre.
Oh, yeah. For everyone to see.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be nice. Yeah.
Sadler, repeat viewing.
So, I don't know how many times I've seen this film. Quite a lot. First at the cinema, and then I bought it on DVD. And I actually watched it over Christmas. And definitely didn't need to watch it again for this, because I've seen it so many times. But it was an excuse to watch it again. I was told, actually, that I wasn't allowed to watch it on like the big screen again, because we'd watched it quite recently. But if someone said, tomorrow, do you want to watch it? I'd be like, yeah, I would. It's like one of those films, like you have your complete go-tos, and this is one for me. And it does continue to reward on the repeat watches. So if you're kind of interested, if you enjoyed it the first time round, then I'd definitely recommend that you watch it at least two times, maybe even more. So for me, it's a 5.
Yeah, I'm going to go for a 4.2 here. It's one, I haven't watched it much, and that's probably just because I've never had free access to it. But it's one of those things where after watching the first time, I was like, I need to rewatch that again. I just never got around to it. And I feel the need to do what Helen Sadler was saying and try and pick out when he's whichever twin. Because that seems like quite an interesting game to play. I might check out.
I'd love to watch it with the Helen Sadler commentary. I really would.
It'd be more fun than the Christopher Nolan commentary, I bet you. Like, I mean, a talented filmmaker, but he's just so dry. I don't mean to rag on Christopher Nolan, I don't, but yeah, well, I kind of do. Anyway.
Small screen score. This is typically where recent Christopher Nolan films would fail for me, but let's see what this produces. Helen O'Hara.
Yeah, I don't think this suffers at all from the small screen. I'm going to go 5 here because it is in the character work, and there are gorgeous images in it. You know, the top hats in the forest has really stayed with me since, and some of the Tesla stuff. But I don't think you need the big screen to enjoy it. So I'm going to go 5 on this.
Yeah, it's Osman.
Yeah, well, I watched it again on the 6-foot screen, and it was it was very kind of enveloping. Because of like the sets and the sort of depth of it. So I'll give it, I feel like I'm failing you on the small screen score because that's a large size screen. But yeah, I'll give it 4.5 for that.
Helen Sadler.
I enjoyed seeing it at the cinema, but the subsequent many watches on the, it was really interesting because 2016, the year when you had two films about magicians came out quite soon.
Was it 2016?
Sorry, 2006.
Yeah. It's the other one, the Jessica Biel.
Yeah, the Illusionist, right?
Yeah, which is Edward Norton's in that one. And I'm a huge Edward Norton fan. And yeah, I think I've probably only seen that one once.
Yeah.
Whereas this one just kind of, I think, was the better, although I haven't seen it recently to make that judgment, but probably, I think.
A Mitchell and Webb one.
Oh, maybe, actually. Magicians, maybe. But I will say, The Illusionist, like, it's fine, but it's not even the best film called The Illusionist, because the Sylvain Chomet animated film called The Illusionist is a better film called The Illusionist. So,
Magicians was 2007, so, yeah, a lot of hot pairs of Magicians films in a short space of time.
Armageddon, Deep Impact, Greenland. Yeah, well, obviously Greenland happened a long time after. Sorry, Helen Sadler, what was your score? What was your small screen score?
I'm going to give it a 5. I think it works perfectly well on the small screen because it kind of has that kind of nice, warm, glowy feel to it.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 5 as well. If this had come out this year, I wouldn't have felt the need to go to watch it in the cinema like I did Tenet. And it tells, you know, it keeps you in the story well on a small screen where I think if you're at home watching Tenet or Interstellar, for me, I probably would have I'd be pausing all the time, going making coffee, doing my tax returns, coming back, watching installments. That's a bit harsh. But yeah, engagement score, Helen O'Hara.
I think this is a 4 again, because I feel like I could, it is long enough that there is a chance that I would get up and leave, you know, once I put it on TV. I've had it on DVD for years since it came out. So like it is available to me, has been available to me for a long time. So it is feasible and possible that I would step away. But generally speaking, I think if I came into the room, it was on, I would probably be here for the duration.
Zaltzman.
Yeah. I think one of the main problems was that I didn't like anyone in it, or at least not anyone who wasn't killed within a few minutes. And I felt like I was being deliberately misdirected so much that it meant that I just thought, well, there's no point really engaging with what I'm being told at this stage of the story, because they're deliberately trying to be like, well, but ta-da, later. So for me, that meant it was like a 1.5. I'm really sorry. Like, I really don't want to rag on a film you all love. I just really didn't like it.
Hey, we didn't make it. It's fine. Yeah. It's fine.
No,
fine.
But like, I don't want to be like, oh, you know, just being difficult.
No, but that is usually a problem for me as well, is when there isn't anybody in a film that I like at all. I find it really, really hard to engage. Weirdly, in this one, I like different people at different times, and I think that keeps me going. If you fix your star to Michael Caine, that helps, I think.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking Caine and obviously, I don't know, just Bowie as well.
Yeah, obviously Bowie, yeah.
So 1.5 was it, Helen? Okay, Zaltzman.
I was waiting for Dr. Octopus stuff to happen with the Tesla machine, so that kept me on the edge of my seat.
Helen Sadler.
Not this film, sadly. It's interesting, because from what you're saying, I wonder if I was to watch it for the first time now, whether I would enjoy it as much with, I don't know, all the other films that are out there. And, you know, the more I watch it, the more I kind of like just feel a bit sorry for Scarlett Johansson, who is trying the best she can, but hasn't really got that much to work with. And so I think I was, it's not, and it's just, it's like, oh, just hire another English actress, maybe that could resolve it.
Does she get any kind of resolution, her character?
Well, she's just sort of like a thing where he's like, go off and do something that's useful for me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, she leaves him because he's obviously unable to express any kind of sadness over the death of Sarah, because that's he is genuinely in love with her. And she leaves him on that. She takes like the moral high ground and go, no, I'm done with a lot of you. You men are insane. You're too crazy. Goodbye. I think engage is like, even when I watch it now, I'm still super engaged. And the more you watch it and pay attention to it, you know, the film says, well, are you watching closely? Like, the closer you watch, the more you'll get. So I'm going to give it a 5.
I think one thing is, there's a flight of fancy with Tesla making duplications of people and cats and hats. But the thing with the twins is always, it kind of always irritates me, because I know a couple of sets of twins, none of them particularly well, but I know them enough now after seeing them maybe like 10 times to tell the difference between them quite quickly. So the fact that people were intimate with twins and couldn't tell there was something going on is a bit irksome.
They have made their whole life. Yeah, they have built their whole life around acting the same way and having the same information.
I know. And Sarah does work it out.
She knows, which is why she couldn't carry on anymore. So the people kind of know. Mm. And obviously, Michael Caine's character says it from the start, it's a twin.
Did he say it's a twin or just a double?
A double.
No. I was wondering how identical twins feel about watching films like this. Are they like, yes, cool being an identical twin, look? Or are they like, it's very reductive, just treating us like we're, you know, a spare person that you can do magic tricks with or cut the fingers off or kill?
Yeah.
Spare meat person.
Yeah. You'd definitely want to do some magic tricks with them, though, wouldn't you, after watching this?
Yeah. Or at the very least, stuff like, wasn't it Linda Hamilton in Terminator?
Oh, my goodness,
got her own twin to play her double.
Oh, yeah,
true. You can do clever stuff like that.
That is amazing.
I'm surprised, there's not more. The London twins, Jeremy and, is it Jack? They should have done more stuff together.
Yeah. Let's get Jedward in this film.
Oh, my God, that would have made it so much better.
Would it? Would it have? Would it?
Well, it'd be different.
Funnier, yeah.
It would be funnier.
Would it have been funnier, though?
Although I feel like Nolan doesn't do funny.
By Nolan standards, this film is hilarious.
I'm going to go for 4.5. Apart from that, the twins take him out of the game. Ish. I still, and I think I just go back to my first time watching it and just being like, oh, good. Well done. Yeah, well done. And the score there is 4.06250.
Wow. That's good.
I think it's lower than Interstellar. Not Interstellar. It's lower than Inception scored.
That's probably my fault for dragging down the average.
No, don't. It's no one's fault. It's
no one's
good.
Fault. No, you've got to be.
No, we all know your heart.
This is the way the scores work. The spreadsheet has the power.
Yeah. the spreadsheet.
The spreadsheet. All the power's in the spreadsheet. So, yeah, do follow us on Twitter, guys. We are at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter. And the main reason to follow us is because each time we record, we put a little tweet on Twitter. And in this case, saying we're watching The Prestige with Helen Zaltzman and Helen O'Hara from Empire Magazine and Illusionist Show. Have you seen it? Tell us your thoughts. And you'll score out 5 stars for an on-air shout-out. And we did have a few responses. I thought there would be from Prestige stands, Christopher Nolan stands. Helen O'Hara, do you want to take the first one that you see on your screen?
Sure. It's from at StuntGoat75, a.k.a. Nice. Nicholas Daniel. And he says, Nolan's best film. The whole film is an immaculate illusion, keeping us, the audience, guessing right till the end. And it has David Bowie. Well, I can't argue with any of that.
Does it? Let's talk about this David Bowie thing, because I remember him being in the film so much more. But how does he do it? Because is he that good an actor, or is it just his presence, or is it just that it's just David
presence,
Bowie, man?
His presence, yeah.
Presence, yeah.
Helen Zaltzman, next one.
This is from Easy Rider's Raging Podcast. It reads like a 5-star, although they don't actually put a number in it. They say, for me, it's Nolan's best film. Yes, even better than The Dark Knight. It's Wolverine and Batman as rival magicians, with bloody Michael Caine explaining screenplay structure, and David Bowie reminding us he was the absolute boss.
Yes.
Strong, strong review.
He does come out with a tweet later on with a 5-star gif, so we'll accept that. Helen Sadler.
This is from Christopher Jones at Plastic Percy. Easily the most complete film Nolan has released. Each rewatch brings something new and incredible to realise that the film literally uses the prestige to direct / misdirect the viewer. 5 out of 5 stars.
Nice. And Helen O'Hara, do you see another one?
I do, yes. James _ S. Wilson says, my personal third favourite film of all time after, and I love this, 2001 and Top Secret, which is one of my favourite films. Endlessly rewatchable and one of the best hidden in plain sight twists.
I think I do need to rewatch it sooner and do the Helen Sadler. I wonder if there's a guide online that that tells you when is Alfred and... What's the name? Alfred,
I think it's Albert and Freddy.
Albert and Freddy. When is Albert and when is Freddy? That'll be quite an interesting deep dive tonight before I go to bed. Maybe on Reddit.
Now I want to do a double bill of this with Top Secret. That would be amazing.
you never talk about Top Secret on Empire Magazine podcast. You and Chris Hewitt never ever mention that film.
So good. We're like a two-person cult for the whole thing.
There's a few people we know from our quiz team who love Top Secret a bit. I've tried. I just don't get it. I just don't get it.
Oh, I love God, Top. How do you know? I know a little German. He's over there. No, nothing. I'm sorry. He's just a little horse.
I saw it for the first time last year, and I wish I'd have seen it when I was a bit younger. Because some of the stuff is still very, very, very funny, and then some of it was a bit like, oh, I wish I'd have been 10 years old.
So good.
Zaltzman and O'Hara, can you tell us where we can find you online, what you're up to, and say sayonara to everyone who's listening?
I'm Helen Zaltzman. You can find me at Helen Zaltzman on Twitter. I'm really sorry for yucking on your prestige yum.
Don't apologise.
You can hear my podcast, Answer Me This, Veronica Mars Investigations, and The Allusionist. That is spelt with an A, not an I, because it's not about magic. But it is about etymology. And in The Prestige, you learn the etymology of the word prestige, which I was interested in. And there's plenty more interesting word origins in that show.
Is that actually where prestige comes from?
Yeah, okay. They did not bullshit about that, Kobe.
Also, we should just remind people that if you're listening to this episode before the 26th of February,
27th, yeah, then you can watch the Veronica Mars 2014 movie with me and Jenny Owen Youngs.
Fantastic.
At VMI Pod, we will be live tweeting
O'Hara.
Hello, yes, I'm on Twitter at Helen L. O'Hara, and you can often find me on the Empire podcast as well. And then my book, Women vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film, is in all good and evil newsagents. It's in all bookshops, basically, hopefully, from as you listen to this now, I think, right? Now, yeah. Pretty much now. Go get it. Or don't.
Bye.
Well, thank you very much, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure to have all the Helens on one podcast. Do come back again.
Hurrah!
Thanks so much for coming on.
Bye.
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 Thanks, guys.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell him FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.